This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this edition of the show. I'm here in studio right now with Peter Robbins, and we're going to be talking about his new book and the Travis documentary as well, if we have time. Hello, Peter.
Good evening, Soraya. Great to be back in the studio.
And I want to say also to the people who are patrons of the show, there is a Nick Redfern bit I'm going to be putting up. I just didn't get to it this week. It will be up, as well as you're going to have access, early access to the midweek podcast that I just did yesterday, as well as the Gary Evans interview I just did yesterday. And they'll be up eventually, but for patrons, you're going to get them sooner rather than later. Plus the extra savings. Maybe we'll do something extra with Peter here, too, tonight. But tonight, we're talking about Halt in Woodbridge, your new book. And I honestly just finished reading it today because I've been so busy this week, and I just kind of like sat down and read most of it tonight. And it's a very interesting book.
Thank you, Soraya. As you know, and my other readers know, this is not a book that I wanted to write, nor that I enjoyed writing. The irony is that I was compelled to write it, and in doing so, I did some of the best investigative work I've done in years, and I resent the hell out of it.
Yeah, well, basically what you did is you took Colonel Halt's talk and you pulled apart all the points he made and showed how they were not true.
Yeah.
Now, I think the most damning thing that he points out is that Larry did sort of lie in the beginning about what he experienced versus what others experienced. And that kind of muddied the waters, but after that, everything's pretty crystal clear.
Yeah, that phrase, Larry changed his story, has haunted Larry for years. As you know from a careful reading of the book, almost immediately after, he sat down with another one of the men who was involved, Adrian Bastinza, a sergeant who was also a security cop on D flight, and stood right next to Larry in the field that night as things happened. And Adrian, we now know from his historic interview just this past August on Encounters, John Burroughs' show on KGRA. This is a witness who has made a few statements over the past 3.5 decades, but has never fully come forward. Readers of Left at Eastgate know that Larry had very much wanted him to come forward to back up what they discussed and that Larry put forward as his, as opposed to their experience at that point. He never did, and we now know it's because his life was threatened early on. He is now retired and working with kids in Texas. I think he's got tremendous courage. I'm off on a bit of a tangent here, but yeah. What Charles Halt did was, I never actually counted the number of data points, but let's say it was 35 or 40 specific allegations. If it was 35, 33 of them were inaccurate, completely inaccurate. Yeah. And upon listening to the talk for the first time in July, a few days after it happened, I was shocked. I was angry. And then I guess I was a bit bewildered. Is it possible for somebody to make that many factual errors without intention? You really would have to be either the worst investigator in the world or some of them would have had to have been intentional, I mean, statistically speaking, which is not a fun thing to accuse anyone of.
Did he also, am I correct in that he banned you guys from attending this?
Yeah, and this is important for anyone to be aware of. Part of the backstory, and as I worked on the response, I had not intended it to be a book, I realized that writing a book about part of a talk that somebody gave on an afternoon was really stretching it. And so it very naturally occurred to me to fit it into the bigger picture of his doing this and try to discredit Larry for three decades, citing absolute specifics as we went along, and then couch the more immediate story in the larger story. The talk itself had been promoted starting this past winter and into the spring. About 3 months beforehand, Larry and I and John Burroughs, and I think there was one other person, were specifically informed that we, if we showed up to attend the talk, not that John or I had intentions of being in England at the time, nor Larry coming down necessarily from Liverpool, that even if we had our £20 entry fee, about $30 US, we would be turned away at the door. And that's not a good sign. What was it that he didn't want us to hear was our question.
Yeah.
I immediately contacted the organizer, John Hansen, and said, look, if I give my word to Charles through you that I will not create a scene in the hall, something I'm not known for doing, and that I will behave myself, can I be there? And 2 days later, I heard back from John. Charles had said, okay. Of course, I wasn't there. But even so, he said, no, John and Larry would still be excluded. The first part of the talk was very much what I hoped it would be. And again, I encourage anyone who reads or doesn't read the book to listen to the talk for themselves. It's well posted on YouTube. And hear what he says and how he says it. But the first part, indeed, was about his experiences as a command person. And as a witness at the same time. It was the last 35 or 40 minutes of the talk where he zeroed in on Left at East Gate, Larry and myself, and did his best to tear us asunder. But again, with completely false points. And that was not right, that was not fair, and it needed to be responded to, and hence the book Halt in Woodbridge.
And why is he so adamant that Larry wasn't there?
Well, as you know, he says throughout the book, Larry wasn't there, but maybe he was there.
Yeah.
Where we now know, going back more than 20 years from our meeting with him in person, in a food court, in a shopping mall directly across the highway from the Pentagon in the early 90s, we had the relevant paperwork establishing that Larry was there, that he had his full PRP or personal recognizance pledge, that he was doing his job with on-the-job training, but most certainly he was posted and working several weeks beforehand. And yet he still brings this up again, knowing that it's not true, and then now we'll say, well, is it or isn't it? Well, it is, and he knows it. The deceptions, the untruths took several forms. There were the ones where he cites page numbers, specific page numbers in Left at Eastgate. And on about half of them, the information that he says is there is simply not there.
Yeah.
On other ones, he will say, Larry said, and a perfect example is, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, Larry said that vehicle that Colonel Williams was in, Gordon Williams, the base wing commander, came down the logging road and then drove into the field, which it couldn't have because there's a big berm to go over, there's a lot of undergrowth, and there was a barbed wire fence. And yet when you go to the actual quote in the book, Larry never says anything like it. Yeah. The vehicle drove as far as it could. The colonel got out, spoke to other command personnel, went into the field. He also does something that I thought was really dirty pool. At one point, he says, in so many words, he says that the men that he had a sidearm. We don't assign sidearms to security cops. The he referred to Adrian Bastenza in a 35-year-old interview with Larry Fawcett, a now deceased UFO investigator. He says, Charles alleges that he says there was a big base meeting the next day and there was no such thing. I would have known. And yet, that's a quote from Greg Batram, another security cop, also 35-year-old interview. But putting these things in to mislead people, to make them feel that Larry had said something that he could then demonstrably say was wrong. I think my favorite were the times, and he seems insistent on this. Larry says he was standing in this place and he saw X, yet earlier that night I was in the same location and I saw Y.
Yeah, like the cows and...
Yeah.
There were no cows in the field, and then later Larry sees the cows, but there can't be because there were no cows in the field earlier.
Except that he also says there must have been cows there fairly recently because one of my men stepped in something one of the cows left.
Right, right.
And yet he still adamantly hunkers down on the position. I would like nothing more than an opportunity to address these differences with Mr. Hall, and I would certainly be happy for him to set the terms if he wanted to do it on a radio show or live. I would submit questions in advance, no ambushing. I wish him well on a personal basis. And I guess for me, what it comes down to is, has there been pressure on him from higher up?
Yeah.
The awkward question of dovetailing off of the fact, established fact, that so many of the firsthand witnesses were put through what we'll call Disneyland on acid and really worked over by intelligence. Was he dealt with in this manner at somewhere along the line? Has his obsession with wanting to bring Larry down, which goes back to the early 80s, become so ingrained in his character that it may be a diagnosable psychological condition and obsession? I even asked the very serious question in the conclusions, is it possible at 75 years old that he's having some memory issues? I don't think these are viable, and I establish why after asking the questions. But one thing is for sure. With the aid of a friend in the UK who worked as a legal clerk, who was kind enough to pull up and send me all the information that was relevant about slander under English law, which is quite different than it is here in the States.
Yeah.
It is still a misdemeanor there, but were Larry to take him to court, even if he could collect or not, the fine could be severe, and it could also involve a year or two in jail. And that is serious. Larry, my co-author, Larry Warren's attorneys now all have copies of the book and are going through it. Whether or not he chooses to bring this to court is his business. I've done the research for it. I think it's more important at this point that in the court of public opinion, these things be made public, as I have, and that they be addressed. And as I mentioned to you right before we went on the air, we have learned that Charles Hall will have a book out, I'm assuming next year, that he, I know, has wanted to have out for at least 20, 25 years. He's made that clear, and I know a number of authors that he's approached over the years. The co-author will be a British writer named John Hansen, who has been a supporter of Mr. Hall's for years and who, in fact, set up the event in July that he spoke at, made the invitation, brought him over, etc. So I wish them well on the book, and I hope that when they do publish it, it gives us a chance to see if he's been able to address any of the points.
Yeah.
If not, then that's a missed opportunity.
Well, here's the thing, too. I mean, did he not know it was going to be recorded? I mean, did he think he could
knew well it was going to be recorded, and the person who shot the film Ben Emlyn Jones, who happens to have a radio show out of Oxford, England, who does video work, had been invited to do so by John Hansen, the organizer, and was highly visible. He was right at the front side. Mr. Holt could have seen him filming him the whole time. It was understood that it would be filmed. So at that point where he shifts gears and tears into Larry and left at East Gate, and by extension myself, it was intentional. I mean, you know, it was to do. And I wonder sometimes about the people who are in the audience who are now aware that the whole last part of this talk that they paid $30 to hear, if they were local. I had one friend who came down from Scotland, and the weekend cost him almost £500.
Wow.
Train fares are expensive, staying over to bed and breakfast,
yep.
transportation, and he was furious. I mean, he knew what he was hearing was at least to some degree inaccurate.
I mean, did he just think people wouldn't notice? Or they'd,
Why
would he do that?
When you watch the actual filming of it, which I'm guessing because of your schedule you haven't been able to do yet, I think you'll find it fascinating on a number of levels. He, at first, speaks... His confidence comes on as he starts to talk about this. And he uses certain set phrases like, if the information came to him from X, that the guy is a really good friend of mine. He spoke with authority. He spoke knowing that people in the audience regarded him with respect as an honorably retired United States Air Force colonel, that they were there in good faith to want to hear what he had to say. I doubt anybody in the audience had a copy of Left at East Gate in their lap to look up things said. And I think part of it was, the hope that if you speak with enough authority and you drive the point home by saying, take my word for it, or I've got the evidence. And it's another thing that's very frustrating about the talk. Every single point against us, he says he has evidence to back up in the form of documents or emails or what have you. And yet, even with a full PowerPoint behind him, he shows absolutely nothing. One thing I'm a little clear on, I think, is he says three or four times in the talk, I've given this material to friends in England. I've given this to the organizers. I am now imagining that at least some of this material will make its way into his and John Hansen's book. But again, if he repeats things that have already been clearly stated in a book now published in England that are true in print, that we've already established in print are not true, and in legal terms with exhibits to back it up, I don't envy John Hansen's position.
And what you do in this book... You take apart what he says. You take exactly what he says, you print it, and then you lay out the evidence to show that why that is not true. You have quotes from, obviously, Lefty Eastgate. You have the actual documents in some cases that he's saying either don't exist or are not what they actually are. So you've presented, I mean, everything to counter him. It's not sort of a your word versus his word.
Yeah.
You're actually showing, you know, you have the bits from interviews. You have, like, for instance, a picture where he's saying the top of the picture is cut off, and you present the picture, and the top of the picture is not cut off.
No. This, for me, was fascinating, kind of a Mr. Spock kind of moment. That really is putting yourself out on a branch where there's nothing to support you except the bravado of your actual speaking and the hope that nobody will check it out for themselves.
And that's part of the problem.
It is. I'm very right-brained. My original training was as a painter and photographer. Mm-hmm. I've lived a life in the creative world primarily, but we all have in the left part of our brain a little attorney that we occasionally consult. And when you do investigative work, often the best way to approach it is kind of in the courtroom of your mind. And you don't want to be dry or boring, but you want to present real information in a lively and informed way that makes for, I'd like to think, good, compelling reading, but that is so hyper-specific in the allegations you're making with respect to the individual. I don't say till the conclusions in the book that I had made a decision at the very beginning that, bearing in mind that there was a chance that I might be putting myself in legal jeopardy by writing a book like this,
yeah.
If he has attorneys and they want to really look it over and see if I've done anything to assail his character under American slander laws, then I might have a problem. But that I had made a decision that I would not speak to any attorney, friend or otherwise, until after the book was published. Maybe it was risky, maybe it was a bit naive, but I think it's going to reflect fine on me.
Well, there's no point that I can see where you're attacking him.
No.
You're simply saying, this is what he said. Well, here's the evidence that he's wrong. Here's the pages he cites. Well, that information's not on those pages. He says Larry said this, but in reality, so-and-so said this.
That was the only way to do it. And
he talks about Larry getting the honorable discharge and acts like it was them trying to get rid of him.
And that was the very first allegation, and that was infuriating. To say this guy was definitely not service material and that his behavior caused him to get kicked out, in so many words, that even though he had applied to get out, they gave it to him. They gave him, you know, like they were giving him some big gift, an honorable discharge. But in fact, I lay out the specifics of what's called a 3910 discharge, where I don't know how it works now. Maybe some of your listeners are retired or former Air Force or serving. I don't think it's the same way now as it was when Larry joined up. But you essentially made a business contract with the service branch. In this case, if you train me to be a security police officer, I will do that job to the best of my ability, and that will constitute a business agreement. Larry, immediately upon the advent of these events, did not follow orders. He was told not to talk about it. He did. He was told not to ask about it. He did. He called his mother the next day and was cut off on the call. He was caught going through a filing cabinet. And so at a certain point, he was taken off of his security cop detail and put in an office doing office work. And for one day, they had him moving rocks from point A to point B, which is a lightly veiled way of saying, remember, you have no rights in the military. You're not, you know, your civil rights, your constitutional rights are not in effect when you are serving.
Yeah.
You're under the uniform code of military justice, and we can do whatever the heck we want to with you. Based on that, he spoke with the base attorney, the JAG, who said, yeah, the Air Force broke its contract with you. So Larry left the service because the Air Force had failed on its end of the contract. And Charles makes it sound just the opposite.
Yeah.
He also, in response to a real put-down by the assistant, the MC to the conference, David, forget his last name, not surprisingly, to a really snide remark about honorable discharges that, you know, they're kind of thrown around. Charles Hall also owes the Air Force an apology because he didn't correct them. Honorable discharges are just that. And Larry received a fully honorable one. So, you know, again, once you really get into something like this, the resistance to it, and boy, this was such a miserable project to start. The first 4 or 5 days, I had the greatest writer's block I've ever had. I had to check my Facebook page several times a day. I had to take time out to play with my cat. I had to do this. I had to do that. And then on like the fifth day, I sat down, gritted my teeth, and got to work. And then it started to happen. And 6 weeks later, I had a manuscript for a book.
What are the differences between what, besides Larry being there, what are the differences between the version of events that Halt has and the version of events that Larry has?
Great question. First, both agree on the events of the first night overall involving John Burroughs and Jim Peniston.
Okay.
Both agree that there are real problems with Jim Peniston's account, and even bigger problems with his allegation that the event was generated by time travelers who selected Jim to receive a message from the future to be given to us on Earth now at some point in the future.
Right.
Halt overall, though, denies the reality of the event that Larry Warren was involved in. Later on the third night, an hour or so, I'm guessing, educated guess, after the event that he was involved in, which is, of course, very well known. He and the six or so men that he was with in the Rendlesham Forest observed one of these unknowns pass right over their heads and shine a beam of light down to his feet. And as he says in the book, Sergeant Ball and Sergeant Burroughs were with me the whole time. So therefore, they couldn't have been with Warren. Completely neglecting the tiny fact that these things did not happen at the same time.
Right.
And that after his event was over, yes, they were with Warren in the field called Capel Green, involved in the second event on the third night.
Hmm. So it's not like he's denying these events occurred.
No, he, again, let's remind your listeners that the so-called Rendlesham Forest UFO incident is a series of connected events over three consecutive nights, all within a mile or so of each other in the Rendlesham Forest near these two very important NATO bases, one British, right, one American. In fact, Charles Halt really had no choice but to acknowledge the events because on the 13th of January, bearing in mind that the events ended on the 29th of December, he wrote a one-page memo, known as the Halt document or the Halt memo, that while truncating, compressing, minimizing, redacting certain events, there it is, a confirmation of a multiple UFO event written by a deputy base commander, a full lieutenant colonel, signed on an Air Force letterhead. We know from more recent things that Charles has said that this was not his idea or desire. He was asked, in so many words, to write such a document because none of the higher-ups wanted their signature on it. And when the document was made public, it was first won in a Freedom of Information Act action in earlier 1983. A copy made its way to England and ultimately was reproduced in the News of the World, the largest tabloid in the world at the time when the story broke with Charles's name all over it. So he was the UFO colonel, as one British paper referred to him a number of times, from the get-go, for the time that he was remaining time in the service. And then when he left the service, he made the decision to fully go public with this, at least fully go public with his version of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the more poignant parts of Halt in Woodbridge is in the conclusions, I asked the rhetorical question, is there anything that Larry and I said or wrote about him over the years that could have fed this?
Right, right.
Left at East Gate really has a great index, and if you go to it, you'll see that there are more than 50 individual references to Charles Halt, deputy base commander. Not a single one of them is condescending,
no,
demeaning, or disrespectful. And when the book was republished in its expanded version to mark the 25th anniversary, both Larry and I had a chance to write more. In the original, I do take Charles to task with respect on a certain disagreement that we have, but did nothing to augment that in the revised edition. However, Larry does add two things about Charles in the revised edition, and for people that think this is a difference of opinion, which I hear regularly from people who have not really looked at the material, because if they would, they would see it's not a difference of opinion. It's one person is telling the truth and the other person simply is not.
Right.
Although I guess, you know, if you want to play games with words, you could call that a difference of opinion.
Well, the question is whether or not Halt believes what he's saying.
Ah, I think that originally he did believe at least some of the things that he was saying. But again, after that meeting 23 years ago, which was recorded with his permission, the transcript of which appears, approved by him, in Left at Eastgate, you do see that he fully understands at that point, more than 20 years ago, that based on the paperwork he is seeing, that Larry is correct in that allegation, and where we had left off before we actually met was you bring your paperwork, I'll bring mine. I have paperwork that establishes that he couldn't have been there. And both Larry and I wish that we had pushed them on that point. In fact, we were embarrassed for him sitting at that table because his paperwork that he chose not to show us or maybe even didn't bring with him was not accurate, or he certainly would have pulled it out and made the point.
Right.
I just wanted to complete the thought, though, that in the two little things that Larry added in the updated edition of the book, he mentions at one point that in the original disclosure event in 2000 at the National Press Club that Dr. Stephen Greer put together, that brought in Larry and Nick Pope from England and other people mm-hmm. from around the country and the world, that he wished Charles Halt had been there. He was not able to attend. That's not a bad thing. The other thing, and I had forgotten about this until I was rereading parts of Left at Eastgate, by virtue of the fact that Charles Halt has said in public situations, on television, in public forums, and if I'm off here, it's by a word, whatever he and his men saw that night was not built by any government on this planet. Larry said that in itself qualifies him to be called a hero. Mm. I thought, boy, you know, people that really don't know this story would be shocked to see the respect that Larry has always had for Charles, and that it has not been a fight that's been back and forth. It's literally always been instigated by Charles for all these decades, with Larry responding, sometimes very angrily, understandably. But if you're just looking at the response and the allegation, you might think it isn't
right,
what
right,
it
back
is.
Back and forth,
Yeah.
And again, you have to wonder what Halt's motivation is. Like, why is he doing this? Why is he, you know, does he really believe this? Is he losing it a little bit? Does he have some other motivation there that's causing him to do these things?
Well, one thing I think is, and this should be clear, the events happened in December of 1980. Not long before that, he had already been approved for a promotion. And in fact, within a week of the events, that promotion did proceed, and he went from being lieutenant colonel to colonel and earned it. He stayed in the service for almost another dozen years, and he never advanced another micro rank. I have made a habit over the years when I speak to Air Force personnel, retired Air Force, former, and lay out the specifics of the situation. I've never spoken to anybody knowledgeable on this dynamic, because I am not, who has said they felt that he should have retired as less than a one-star brigadier general. Gordon Williams, who was also involved, who kept his head lower, who was, I think, better protected, left the service a few years after the event as a two-star general. So this hurt Charles Halt's career, being associated with the subject. The ridicule factor in the hyper-macho culture of the military is even worse than civilian life.
Oh, sure.
And it was something that was used against him in civilian life to poke fun at him, which is not fun. So there is that as well. But again, if there's been pressure on him or, you know, in a mercantile sense, if he wants his book to come out and sooner or later, somebody will probably make a movie on the Rendlesham Forest incident.
I'm surprised they haven't already.
Yeah, me too. And Will it be the Charles Halt version? Will it be the Left at Eastgate version? Will it be another version? The encounter in the Rendlesham Forest by Nick Pope, right, John Burroughs, right, and Jim? It remains to be seen.
Or some fictionalized version in between.
Yeah, you never know. And of course, Hollywood hasn't committed itself yet, so...
Which is really surprising. I mean, with all the Roswell stuff, maybe because Rendlesham isn't quite as well known?
That may be part of it, but I think anybody in a position to really start to look this over as a film project would, in the course of even basically educating themselves, would see that there's contention. And unless you're a really huge studio and you've got enough money to just throw at everybody, how do you deal with telling one variation on the story, incorporating in other characters as one would have to, with respect to them, and not want their lawyers to get in your face? It's a delicate dance, I would imagine.
It is. Or they could go the way they did with the Mothman Prophecies, you know, where it wasn't the story that John Keel did, but it had the feel and the resemblance of it.
Yeah. And that was quite a compelling film.
Yes, I absolutely loved it. I mean, it was like, oh, okay, so it's a modern day version, but it feels right.
Yes, it did.
And it had some of the events mixed into the fiction, and it was like, okay, this was good.
It was nicely creepy. It was well done.
Creepy's
fine performances
a good word.
By Richard Gere and by the actress who plays his deceased wife.
Yeah, I don't remember.
She was sensational as well.
I think the only thing where they dropped the ball on that was the promo for it.
Yeah.
Because they did the chapstick thing. And in the context of the movie, that's a creepy moment.
That's a good point.
But in just the promo, it seems silly.
I also think that magic phrase, based on real events, then you've got all the latitude in the world. But I think there would be some filmmakers who would fight the fight to do their best to produce a film that was as accurate and authentic as possible. Again, this all remains to be seen, and
true,
when we get an option, you'll be the first to know. I will scream very loud.
I bet. Now, one of the other things he attacks is the allegations of underground tunnels on Rendlesham.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that these don't exist.
Yeah.
Now, you can't say 100% that they do, correct?
Well, I can say that people that I did in-depth interviews with, including contractors, British contractors with the right security clearances, who had worked on the base, because the way that it works is you bring in civilian contractors, you give them a security clearance, and you hope that they keep their word and
right,
don't talk.
Right.
We do have testimony about a number of tunnels underground. Whether or not they hook up with deeper tunnels is the question. And the question is also, do we take the point of view that a deputy base commander, which is an important job on a military base, but one where you're there for X number of years and then you're transferred out, is it like the President of the United States being cleared to know by the intelligence community the truth about UFOs? Or you are kept in the dark, or you are cleared to know, and you do know, and part of your job is to adamantly deny it if it ever comes up.
True.
And I think one thing about officers overall is you develop a command presence. You have got to play the role to be taken seriously by your men. You can't show indecision or weakness. And whether or not Charles Halt is feigning a position or passionately does believe what he believes, we don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the underground tunnel thing is definitely interesting. It wouldn't be surprising. I mean, there's plenty of bases that have these type of structures.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised if they didn't.
Going back 25 years or so, the first time that I heard the phrase secret underground military facility or variations on that, I cringed. It's so Flash Gordon. But in fact, you know, you go off on tangents in investigative work and you learn things. In our realm, the work of Dr. Richard Sauder is, I'd say, as appropriate group of books as I could recommend. Dr. Sauder has made underground bases his specialty over the decades. And he backs up my allegations better than I could ever do, being a really specific researcher in that area.
Right.
But underground military facilities exist all over the world.
Oh, certainly.
And there's no reason that there would not be ones there in such a highly militarized part of England. And God knows there's stuff going on underground all over the world.
Yeah.
I think even those of us that study the subject would be dumbstruck by.
Yeah. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with Peter Robbins.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight we're speaking with Peter Robbins. We've been talking so far about Halt and Woodbridge, your new book, and this is available on Amazon. And we should probably tell people that you have a website as well.
Yes. In fact, this is the, well, how can I say? This is the premiere announcement. It will be up within the next 24 hours.
Well, technically it is up.
Yeah. PeterRobbins.net.
No, it's PeterRobbinsNewYork.com.
Like I was saying, PeterRobbinsNewYork.com.
That's NY, to be clear. So
yes.
It's PeterRobbinsNY.com. We were going with the other one, and we went with this.
And in fact, the person directly across the table from me is my webmaster,
yes.
Hail Soraya.
Thank you.
And it will grow over the next weeks and months, so I encourage you to visit it. In the meantime, you can stay in contact with me on Facebook. And if you are not a friend, let us become friends.
And there will be links to everything on here. We're going to have a bunch of your old articles and such up, where there's a bio up in case people want to know a little bit more about what you've done, which is pretty extensive. You can contact you. There'll be links to videos. There's going to be all kinds of stuff coming up.
Radio shows like this.
Yep.
Also, ultimately, photo section and
your
a
upcoming
blog.
And your upcoming events.
Absolutely,
and,
absolutely.
So the last thing I really wanted to cover on this book was was his comments about Bud Hopkins. Now you were very close with Bud.
I was.
And the way he kind of presents it is, you just kind of sort of knew Bud, but he was good friends with Bud.
That's right. And this once again, you can so badly distort in the individual's relationship with another individual by what you don't say. Mr. Halt goes out of his way to say that Larry and I met with Bud once or twice, when in reality, I worked as Bud Hopkins' assistant and for much of that time his confidant, or one of them, for 15 years on and off. We were very close friends for 35 years. And once again, I resented his trying to shape the reader's opinion by what he did not say. If he wanted to mention Bud, he should have at least done the courtesy of saying that Larry and I were friends. And while saying that Bud did not take Larry's account seriously in so many words, we see by Bud's words how seriously he did take it. I felt a little awkward for Charles because I knew that he was working from the first edition of the book, seemingly unaware that Bud wrote the foreword to the second edition of the book, which was glowing. It was the kind of foreword that any writers would be proud of. And Bud does not mince his words. He followed the case with me from the time I got involved in 1987, and he was my major confidant over the years that I worked on the book with Larry. Spent quite a bit of time with Larry as well as me over the years. And again, Charles he's hoping that people will not look into this for themselves. If one went to that talk in July in Woodbridge, Suffolk, and simply relied on what he had presented, you would have walked away with a head full of completely erroneous information.
Yeah.
And that, there's a great Yiddish word, chutzpah, gall, nerve, to stand up there and look that audience in the eye and repeatedly assure them that you were telling them the truth and, in fact, that you weren't.
Yeah.
That's a real problem, and there shouldn't be room for it in our field. Also, the fact that it was made clear beforehand that he would not be taking any spontaneous questions from the floor about anything that he had just said, that questions would have to be submitted in advance on 3x5 cards.
And then approved.
He does end by taking one of those questions, which is from actually the MC, who says, in so many words, do you see a time when you and Larry and others might sit down and talk this thing out? And his response is, why should I? He's a fraud.
Yeah.
And then he goes on to say, you know, at one point he sent me a cease and desist letter because he didn't like what I was saying, and I show the letter. And let's go to court. Let's take depositions. Like, take depositions from his ex-wives and see what happens. Not a really swift thing to do. That is literally how he ends the talk. And boy, wife number two, who has a great relationship with wife number one, who both have very good relationships with ex-husband, laid into Mr. Hault in a way that I would not want anybody to lay into me. That deposition has been taken. So it's up to Larry and his lawyers now.
Yeah.
Barristers and solicitors, I mean.
Yeah, yeah. And Larry lives in the UK.
He does. He has been a legal resident of the great city of Liverpool for 15 years now, almost 16.
All right, so let's move on to this new documentary.
Mm.
And so you're involved with two of the most probably impressive UFO cases out there. Rendlesham being obviously one with a decent amount of evidence that something happened there.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you and I disagree a little on Roswell, but like Roswell so far in the past, it's hard to, you know something happened, but what becomes very blurry and hard to prove at this point.
Yeah.
With Rendlesham, something anomalous happened.
Yeah.
Now, what it may end up being, who knows? But you can't say, oh, it was nothing. You know, there was an anomalous event there, something, whether it be extraterrestrial, time travelers, or just some weird Earth-based, who knows?
Exactly.
There's so many explanations that could fit this, interdimensional encounters.
I have never figured it out. I don't think I ever will, and I've never gone on record as saying it's this, that, or the other thing.
Right, right. But we know something happened.
You bet.
And something very strange.
Yes.
And this next one, which is the case of Travis Walton, is very much the same. We know something happened to Travis.
Indeed.
And the documentary, now they made a movie, Fire in the Sky, which, you know, I liked it when it came out. And when I tried to rewatch it, I was just like, this is bad.
Yeah.
And it doesn't cover his encounter, really. No. Not what really happened.
No. A quick backstory here. Between the 5th and the 8th of November last month, there was a conference in Arizona, very close to where the events happened, to mark not just the event, but the 40th anniversary of the event. Mm. Travis Walton had his experience on November 5th, 1975. And one of the speakers who also spoke at the conference last year, the first year we got it up, was the guy who actually wrote the screenplay. And that's Tracy Torme, who's done some important writing on UFO-related dramas on television and films over the years. And Tracy retold the story of where a lot of us feel things really screwed up, which was the book was optioned, the film was budgeted, everything was green-lighted, and they are now on location making the film. And Tracy and Travis get a phone call from the head of the studio. Brandon Tartikoff made his name at NBC in the late 70s, in that he was fortunate enough to be the head of NBC at the time that a new show began and changed the history of television to a degree called Saturday Night Live, which Tracy wrote for and spent time with Bud Hopkins and me to a degree when he was living in New York back then. Tartikoff then went on to head the studio, and I'm damned if I remember which studio it is, that made Fire in the Sky, and told Tracy that he had to rewrite the whole onboard sequence. Well, Tracy asked why, and he said, because I've just seen something on television where they had the same kind of abduction experience. I think it may have been the miniseries on CBS in the early 90s that Tracy wrote based on Intruders and Missing
Time. Okay, yeah.
Which was quite good in many respects,
yes,
and problematic in others, but sure. it was a great drama and had a real core of truth about abductions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Tracy and Travis explain to Tartikoff that this was the way it was, and this was amazing, and this was as wild as anything they could imagine, but this was it, and you wanted to go with it. And he said, let me put it this way. I want something new, something creepier and more anxiety-provoking.
Horror, yeah.
And if you don't, I'll simply pull the plug on this. And within 24 to 48 hours, everybody will be out of work. I will take the several, you know, the multi-million dollar loss, the studio will. What do you want to do? And so they did the rewrite. I think the film works best in terms of the human relationships and the human dynamics between Travis, played by D.B. Sweeney, and the men who were involved, and with law enforcement. And the sheriff, the real Sheriff Gillespie, who is now in his 80s and retired, there's a very poignant part of his interview on the documentary. But the character of Sheriff Gillespie was played, I thought, brilliantly and very thoughtfully by the late, great James Garner.
Yes, yes.
And Travis has always been kind of gentlemanly when questioned on the problems, but he is frustrated that the film came out the way that it did. And part of the push to get this conference together, and it really was a superb conference, was to re-bring attention, the same reason that we're working so hard on this documentary, to the factual story. And hopefully, you know, it's been 20 years or so now, maybe somebody in Hollywood with some vision and integrity will remake it as a more authentic film.
Mm.
But, yeah, the documentary, I'm an associate producer on it and very proud of the role that I've played in it.
Now, it is just called Travis.
It's called Travis, The True Story of Travis Walton.
Right.
And the executive producer, Jennifer Stein, a marvelous filmmaker, I introduced her and Travis in 2010 and am very moved that out of that friendship came this extraordinary project. It's been worked on for some years now. And the reason that there's a version out was because this past February, the big UFO Congress that's held every February in the Phoenix area has an Associated Film Festival. And we very much wanted to have a version, if not the completed version, in that film festival.
Mm.
It was a good move. We were very moved that it won in its category and then won the People's Choice Award.
Nice.
But it's being worked on. A more updated version was shown last month in Arizona, and it was sensational.
Mm.
It's one more cut to go because there were a few interviews that we had to wait till last month to get, including one with Dr. Leo Sprinkle.
Okay.
Sprinkle is a remarkable guy. At the time of these events, he was a psychologist trained in regressive hypnosis working in his home state of Wyoming, where he still lives. And within a few months of the event, he sat down and did a regressive hypnosis with Travis and began to work with him in interviews and recovering memories and the like. And he could have lost his license to practice psychology in the state of Wyoming by taking this story seriously. Leo, I think, was the second mental health professional in the world that I'm aware of to do regressive hypnosis in a UFO investigation. The first would have been Dr. Simon, who worked very closely with Betty and Barney Hill
right.
In the early 60s. Leo gave a wonderful and very moving talk that was simply titled, When I Met Travis. So probably within 2 months or so, the final version of Travis, the true story of Travis Walton, will be available. You can buy the interim form of the DVD now. As much as I'd like to see sales of it happen, I would say to wait a few months. And the place you can get it or to check its progress is a website called On Wings, but Wings with an E, W-I-N-G-E-S, onwings.com. Go right there and you'll be able to order it. And we will be screening this updated version, but not the final version, on the 16th of January in New York City at an event I am really interested to see how the audience is going to receive. I will be there on a panel discussion. I'll be joined by Jennifer Stein, the executive producer. Hopefully, Lee Spiegel, who appears in it and who is the Huffington Post senior UFO-related reporter.
Right.
Philip K. Dick, for the three people in your audience who have never heard his name, is one of the most important, most influential, and finest science fiction writers.
It's such a fascinating guy.
Truly. Truly. And if you have an idea of what he has written and the films that have been based on it, I mean, the man is such a part of popular culture. But it's ironic to me, although not surprising, that the vast majority of the millions and millions of sci-fi fans out there, being rooted in Western culture and growing up the same way we have, take UFOs very seriously in science fiction.
Yes.
But reject it overall the same way most people do, or at least say they do, as a reality.
Mm-hmm.
And due to the quality of the documentary and the amount of actual evidence and testimony and scientific stuff, I'm going to be really curious to see how the audience reacts. It would be great to have more people in the world of science fiction take the science reality behind this anomalous phenomena seriously, wouldn't it?
Yeah. One of the documentary is very well done. I enjoyed it greatly. One of the, I can't remember if this was in the documentary or not, but the skeptic there, what's his name?
Philip Klass.
Thank you.
Yes.
Trying to pay off one of the guys to say that he made it all up.
Very ugly stuff.
That was in the documentary, because it was him talking about it, yeah.
The youngest member of the logging crew is a guy named Steve Pierce, who unfortunately couldn't be with us, although two of the other men in the logging crew were at the conference last month, because his truck broke down in Texas.
Yeah.
I know Steve better than the other guys. He is still haunted by what happened to them back then. And this upset him tremendously. Again, he was the youngest of the guys. I think the oldest was maybe 24, 25. Steve was 17. And he ended up moving and becoming something of a loner.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Klass, as well known a debunker as any that
have
ever
come forward. Not a skeptic, a debunker.
A really nasty piece of work who, ironically, in the book that he makes his major attack on Travis, called UFO Abductions, A Dangerous Game, I believe published in 87, one chapter over, goes at me and my sister for our childhood sighting and takes us to task. But, what he did was terribly underhanded. He found Steve, and he offered to pay him $10,000 to change his story, which is,
that's the way to get at the truth.
Yeah, you and I, $10,000 would be very welcome, real money for us right now.
Absolutely.
If we were blue-collar guys in the late 70s, early 80s, it would be a lot more money, and to have the integrity to turn it down, way to go, Steve. Now, he's pretty disgusting on this, and with all the attacks, he never, ever once contacted Travis to ask to interview him. Why bother? As Stan Friedman says, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's already made up.
Yeah, which is the difference between a skeptic and a debunker.
Yes.
A skeptic has questions. A debunker knows all the answers.
You and I are skeptics. We couldn't be good professionals if we weren't. We better damn well be good skeptics. I mean, tough skeptics, or our reputations will fall on believing something that turns out to be nonsense.
Right.
A debunker knows that there is no such thing. And as Bud used to say, you know, we should be in awe of them because they know that UFOs aren't real. And their job is to explain very patiently to us what presenting sign it is for some dysfunction or what misinterpretation of natural phenomena. It's fairly outrageous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it takes an amazing amount of creativity to come up with some of these answers. And, I mean, in the Travis case, and, I mean, we approach both these cases tonight in the assuming that people know the Rendlesham case, that they know the Travis case. I didn't want to take the time to go over them for the millionth time because I think most of the people listening to the show are familiar with these these cases. But the thing about the Travis case is it's, so, again, one of those things where there's so many people that saw it. It wasn't a, I saw this happen, and that's my story. Yeah. You know, he was hit by the light. Everyone there saw it. They all passed lie detector tests.
Repeatedly.
He was gone for days.
Yeah. 5 days.
It's just a very good case that something very anomalous happened to him. In this case, unlike Rendlesham, it fits the extraterrestrial view, I think, better than Rendlesham does. Because with Rendlesham, you have the light going and like almost exploding in the sky and coming down and turning into fog. And it seems very weird.
Well, the beings did appear on the third night. But you're right. There's more... There's
a flying saucer with a light coming out of it.
Pretty much. I mean, again... With Rendlesham, one of the things that takes people off onto tangents is they hear the Rendlesham Forest incident, and then they hear these differing accounts, and some people don't have it clarified or don't do the field work on their own to understand we're talking about a number of events that happened over three nights as opposed to loggers in the woods. And I'll tell you, one of the real epiphanies for me, Soraya, being part of this event last month, was even knowing Travis for 25 years, being friends for a dozen years or so, working on the documentary, having seen the film, having read Fire in the Sky, having seen, you know, cutaways and photos of the area, nothing prepared me for the real sight. And the conference itself came to an official close about noon on Sunday, November 8th. We had planned, because so many people wanted to visit the area with Travis, the conference rented three big yellow school buses. Mm. And immediately after one bus went out, another one went out an hour later, and I was on the third bus. The Sitgraves National Forest, where they were logging, is 500,000 acres.
Wow.
It's mind-blowing. And it does not look like it looked then. There was a major forest fire several decades ago. And so there's still a lot of areas where it just goes on and on and on with just low growth, where you can see 30 miles without a break. And we drove into the forest 13, 15 miles before we got to the small logging road that we walked down a quarter of a mile to the actual location where Travis was waiting for us. And where he was so generous emotionally and otherwise to go through it all again with us on location. And earlier today, I sent you a series of portraits that I took of him.
Yes.
Some of them very moving, I think. Even though there were several dozen people in proximity, as a photographer, I found a spot where I could just photograph him with that location in the background. And I think we were all pretty exhausted by the end of it. But if there was some humor attached, it was that the first school bus, and thank goodness each one of them was very underfilled, because we all came back on one of them. Because the first one decided, well, it's a quarter of a mile in. Why don't I just drive down the road and people can be right there? There is a road. It's very rough. A four-wheel vehicle could make it. But
not
the first
bus
sank into the mud. Sank right in. The second, it had been very cold previously, but we were there mid-afternoon. The sun was out. The second bus driver felt they could attach the chain and haul the first bus out. Noble effort. Guess what happened to the second?
No.
The third bus, when we pulled up, the driver had the wisdom to stay on the road.
Good.
And after, you know, everybody that was there originally was coming out as we were going in. And then we were all standing there. We did a head count, took a group shot, and all came back on the second bus. And as we were about to leave the forest, a big industrial tow truck was on its way in. And I haven't spoken to Karen Brand, who did a brilliant job as the organizer, a great gal who is a very devoted member of Phoenix MUFON, and just was brilliant. Also Alejandro Rojas, who did a great job of emceeing the event. They were really the front people for it. If they made any money, I'm afraid it all went on that tow truck. So one of the speakers last year and this year, a great guy, Ben Hansen.
Now, wasn't he part of TV show on Sci-Fi?
That's right.
Yeah, Fact or Faked.
That's right, exactly. Yep. And Ben, who is one of the nicest guys you've ever met, very knowledgeable, very serious when he's working, but a lot of fun, just recently married to, real happy for him. Even though he's not old, he is a former FBI profiler.
Yeah, I always found that weird because he was on the show and he looks like he's in his 20s and he's an ex-FBI agent. It's like, wait,
tall,
what?
Handsome guy. Exactly. I don't know the backstory there, but one of the things that he pulled together was working with the polygraph people to establish that for one criminal to lie their way through a polygraph and not get caught is an accomplishment. To coordinate it with a colleague,
group, yeah,
that's really pushing it. But for, say, six or seven people to all carry across the same deception and not to get caught in repeated polygraph tests, he said the conservative FBI figure, and he was stressing conservative, was about 1 in 1 million possibility. That's the FBI stats. But he was waiting for us halfway down the trail and told us something very interesting. First, that although we were going to be visiting the site and people were welcome to come back or bring other people, to please contact Travis as a courtesy to let them know, because we don't want this site to become, a tourist destination.
A mess.
Really.
Yeah.
And he said, if you are taking pictures here with your smartphone and posting them on Facebook or other parts of the social
disable
network.
Disable the locator.
What you want to do is this, that, and the other thing first, or somebody knowledgeable can get the exact...
Yes.
I didn't know this. I'm not a tech person, but it was fascinating and creepy and neat at the same time. I was taking pictures just with my camera at the time, so it wasn't an issue for me. And then again, we made our way in. And overall, it was a brilliantly organized conference, a lot of fun, very moving. And Travis was particularly eloquent. And at one point, Alejandro had Travis and John Ouellette, who was in the crew, and Mike Rogers. Mike is the best known of the individuals in the crew. In the movie, he was played by Robert Patrick, who had just become world famous for his breakthrough role as the liquid metal man in the first Terminator movie.
Ah, yes.
He went on to become a terrific character actor, by the way. Some of your listeners will remember him doing such a great job as Joaquin Phoenix's father in the Johnny Cash biopic.
Mm.
He's done a lot of good work over the years. But in reality, Mike and Travis were best friends. And Mike was the crew chief. And Mike was the man behind the wheel who hit the gas after Travis got blasted by this craft and then stopped the vehicle and went back. But it has weighed on him, and a lot of people have not been kind to him about it. Travis has always said that not only did Mike do the right thing, but it was the courageous thing and the thing, as far as they could assess in that moment, they thought Travis was dead and with good cause.
And I think unless you're in that situation, you don't understand what's going through your head.
Exactly. It's easy for armchair warriors or folks who like to sit at the edges and be critical of others to say these things.
Oh, well, they should have gotten out and checked on them, yeah, and likely gotten zapped too,
I wouldn't have been the one to get out to check on him. I would have just started to think, gee, it's terrible that he's dead.
Yeah. And that is what they thought.
It is. When Travis was hit by this beam of light, and for folks who are not listening, let's spend 60 seconds and give a quick backstory. They had been logging in that part of the forest. They were finishing up. As the sun was going down, they saw a glow on the horizon. I'm a city guy. I don't think like this, but their first thought was maybe forest fire.
Right,
they went to the location. No fire. Glowing disc, 40 feet across or whatever, hanging only 25 or so feet over the site. A fully articulated disc. Travis, macho guy, made an impulsive decision to just jump out and get under it. The other guys are screaming bloody murder to get back in. He has very immediate second thoughts, goes behind a pile of lumber that had been stacked up earlier, and then shortly after makes his move to get out. And this beam of blue light hits him in the chest and throws him at least 10 feet. And when he lands, he's not moving, and there is steam coming off his body.
Yeah.
Bye.
Yeah, exactly.
So in this Q&A, Alejandro asked particularly thoughtful questions of these guys, and they were all at their best. You know, the pain was still there. The reality of it was still there. And it was very, very poignant. There was another panel discussion, too, that was equally enlightening for us. It was with Travis and Chuck Ellison, one of the original investigating law enforcement officers, now in his 80s, and another person that we did a spectacular interview with that will be included at least in part. It also included Leo Sprinkle, the psychologist who worked with Travis originally, and Donald Walton, Travis's brother, who, of course, had a unique point of view through all this.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. And all those things, by the way, are available on DVD. Some of them, I don't know, may be posted on YouTube. But Fire in the Sky is the name of the conference, and one can inquire about DVDs through the conference website.
Nice, nice. And the pictures you sent me, we can put up?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, so I'll put them on the Where'd the Road Go on this blog once it goes into the archive on Monday.
Exactly.
And we'll stick them on your page, too.
Great.
Now that you have one.
Yay!
And what else do you got coming up?
Next month, again on the 16th, of January, I will be taking part in a panel discussion following a screening of the documentary in New York City for the Philip K. Dick Film Festival. Anybody in the greater New York area can check that out. I'm starting to line up speaking jobs for next year, as a lot of us do at this point. And I'm hoping that it will have me back in Arizona at least once this year. We have the big Paradigm Symposium coming up this spring in May in Minnesota. I'm going to be, I found out recently and pleased to be doing it, emceeing this coming year's International MUFON UFO Symposium. I will be the MC, and that will be taking place, I think, in Orlando in August.
Nice.
And who wouldn't want to be in Orlando in August?
Me. I don't like the heat. Heat is bad.
Yeah.
I'll take it in February.
Northeast, exactly. I thought, well, you know, can't be choosers on that. But yeah, a number of interesting things lining up. Larry Warren and I will be speaking at the Glasgow Paranormal Festival in June, I believe, of 2016, and very much looking forward to returning to Scotland. We have something on the fire right now that will get us both back to Rendlesham this year. Nice. To work on a project very close to our heart. And I will, of course, post on my Facebook page and on my brand new website all upcoming events as they're confirmed.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. And are you sick of defending your work on Rendlesham yet?
The fact that I'm pausing is an indication that... sometimes, yes. I am reminded of that wonderful scene in Godfather 3, which plays a lot better now, Godfather 3, after, you know, it's so easy to be critical of it because of Godfather 1 and 2, but it's not a bad film. Mm. And there is a sequence where Al Pacino's character, Michael, is now old. He's a billionaire. He wants to make his peace. He wants to be a philanthropist and give $1 billion to the church or whatever. And, you know, the mob thing still, he can't really pull himself away. And the line is, every time I try to get out, they pull me back in. I was happy not to speak on Roswell last month in Arizona.
Roswell or Rendlesham?
I meant Rendlesham.
Okay.
I said Roswell. I meant Rendlesham. I spoke on a subject that I've been researching for years and was very pleased with the reception I got.
Which
I've continued to develop it. On the origin of the UFO ridicule factor.
Ooh, that's a good one.
How did it happen? Why did it happen, and exactly when was this mindset put in place?
And who was behind it?
Exactement. If I tell you on the air, I might not make it home to my little home in Enfield.
So 5 minutes away.
Exactly. You know, they're waiting outside right now. Oh, the pizza place is still open. Good. That's nice, too.
Well, we'll talk about it some other time. From an undisclosed location that might be here.
A secured underground facility.
There we go.
You have a basement?
Yes, we got one of those.
All right, there you go.
All right. Well, I thank you for spending time with us again.
My pleasure, Soraya. Always great being here. And as some of your listeners know, this is the only show at this point I do from the actual studio, because here we are in beautiful downtown Ithaca,
yeah,
up on the hill, looking down on the regular town, looking up at College Town in this beautiful building. And it's great fun. This is the way everybody used to do radio shows.
Yes, yes.
But now...
And nothing against podcasts.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that people can do that now from their home with a computer is fantastic. But
and a good Yeti mic phone.
Yes.
You sound really
yes.
professional.
But it's nice to be in a radio studio with someone talking rather than having
exactly.
to use a computer.
It's always great to get together with you anyway and to figure out our next step in our plan for world conquest.
All right. Again, I got a midweek podcast with Red Pill Junkie and Joshua Cutchin coming up probably the middle of the week. If you're a patron, you'll get it sooner. As well, I have an extra bit with Nick Redfern, where he talks about some of his scariest moments in research for patrons only. If you want to become a patron, go to the website, wheredidtheroadgo.com. It's only $3 a month. And I'm going to keep getting extra stuff. We're going to have some merchandise. You'll be getting it at a discount, or I might just give it to patrons. I'm not sure yet. It's going to depend on how much it costs me. But it'll be worth it for $3 a month.
Boy, I will just pipe in my last 2 cents. That is a great monthly charge for full access to your archive.
Well, the archive's always free. The archive will always be
free.
Oh,
that's great.
It's
good
just
for you.
These extra bits we're doing right now, and then we're going to add some more stuff on later on. And hopefully, with enough support, I'm going to be able to add a regular second show every week.
Please post anything as you move forward on my Facebook page. I'll be glad to help you promote it. Also, Nick is one of my favorite people in the entire field and a great guy, aside from being a great investigative writer, and now has finished his, I believe, 847th book. Oh, no, 848th, right now.
Someone had left a comment on the YouTube of last week's interview saying,
good.
Nick Redfern, only person who has to defend why he's releasing 3 books at the same time. Or something to that effect.
He's amazing. He is so disciplined and so prolific. We joke about it, but we're all jealous.
All right. So, yes, wheredidtheroadgo.com, Peter's new website, peterrobbinsny.com. And as the week goes on, there's going to be a lot more articles and stuff up there. Right now, there's one and just a bio and some videos, but I was hoping to have everything up by tonight, but it'll be up in the next couple days. All right.
Great.
And we're going to take you out with some Whirring World from Psyche Corporation. And we'll be back, with the midweek, middle of the week. See you then.
Come in. Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Can you hear the knowledge? into the heart of the universe. Ventricles and tetrahedra, chambers number 1597. And counting. And counting. Can you hear?